Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Senator Maurice Payne makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I think this is now the third occasion on which he has addressed us. She's very well known to all of you, so I will be very brief. Maurice Payne has been Senator for New South Wales since 1997. She's held a number of important shadow responsibilities and Senate committee responsibilities over the years, but most significantly since 2013, the Minister for Human Services. And Senator Payne tonight is going to address the Sydney Institute on delivering the best service, addressing family and domestic violence. Senator Payne, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared. To Jared and Anne Henderson, to the Secretary of the Department of Human Services, Catherine Campbell, to the Honourable Stuart Ayres, MP, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet this evening and pay my respects to their elders past and present. It is a pleasure to be here again at the Sydney Institute. It's been some years now since I last had the opportunity to speak here, and in fact, we've had four Prime Ministers since that time. Three from the same party and two of those the same person. So certainly a strange period in Australian politics. It's a great pleasure to address the Sydney Institute again, and this time as the Minister for Human Services. My department is the government service delivery agency, comprising Centrelink, Medicare, Child Support and Australian Hearing. We deliver more than $159 billion in payments each year, including the age pension, the Newstart allowance, the disability support pension and Medicare benefits. In fact, if you have a Medicare card and you're in this room, you are one of my customers. We also lead the Commonwealth Public Servant in the employment of Indigenous Australians, of people with a disability and of women. I'm immensely proud of our workforce, their skills and diversity, their commitment to doing their job, and of the support they give to Australians, often at the most vulnerable times of their lives. Government service delivery, welfare reform, and our recently commenced welfare payments IT transformation that will bring our antiquated payment system into the 21st century are major issues for the Abbott government. And I know that some of you will have heard my colleague, Scott Morrison, the Minister for Social Services, address some of those issues recently here at the Institute. Acknowledging the importance of those, tonight I particularly want to speak more broadly about one of our nation's most pressing concerns, and in my view, a social emergency: family and domestic violence. For some time now, family and domestic violence has certainly been publicly considered a serious issue, but in the last 18 months, it's progressed to a topic of national conversation, which is long overdue. Because frankly, the level of family and domestic violence in Australia in 2015 is alarmingly high and completely unacceptable. Historically, we'd avoided talking openly and frankly about the issue. It wasn't the done thing. It was regarded as private, something to sort out at home. More than unfortunately, some methods of sorting it out at home only involved further violence and, increasingly, deaths. While a number of factors have driven this changed conversation, I want to acknowledge our 2015 Australian of the Year, Rosie Batty, and her remarkable contribution to the national discourse since her son Luke was tragically murdered by his father and her former husband. In her recent address to the National Press Club, Rosie said that after Luke was murdered, the media inevitably congregated at her home. She said that when she walked outside, she had every intention of politely telling the group of journalists to please leave her alone. She didn't want to speak publicly. It was too soon and too raw. As journalists do, they asked for a short comment. It was those comments, unprepared and unrehearsed, that revealed the ugly truth about family and domestic violence in Australia. It happens anywhere, to everyday people who live in everyday suburbs. It can happen to anyone. Since that day, Rosie has shared her infinitely painful story and campaigned for change. In June this year, on what would have been Luke's 13th birthday, she launched the Never Alone campaign to build support for victims of family and domestic violence. We've also seen greater recognition of the issue of family and domestic violence through primary prevention campaigns, including White Ribbon and Our Watch, both Commonwealth supported. These campaigns focus on driving nationwide change in Australia's culture, behaviours and attitudes that lead to violence against women and children. The Male Champions of Change program, brought together by the Sex Discrimination Commissioner Elizabeth Broderick, is another valuable initiative which sees leading and influential men stepping up beside women to help build a gender-equal Australia. I look forward to an opportunity for my department to work with the Male Champions of Change as part of our efforts in this area. One of our most important steps is to recognise that family and domestic violence is not a women's issue. It is everybody's issue. The national conversation needs to continue and, in my view, to expand. We've seen an increase in family and domestic violence reporting in the media. We've seen politicians, male and female, voice their support for change. We've seen companies such as Telstra and National Australia Bank create workplace domestic violence policies. But for those actually experiencing the violence, one suspects the change probably feels slow, and the response from both government and community needs to go further. I think that most of us can do more, including me. Let me start with some of my direct experience of the last 18 months. From the beginning of my role as minister, I received emailed escalation notices about incidents of violence in our service centres. That was certainly not in the incoming government brief. However, as the face of the Australian government, staff in my service centres experience aggressive and violent behaviour at the hands of our customers, which of course happens in other public-facing workplaces. My observation is that this is mostly as a result of customers bringing their own issues and sometimes their personal conflicts into the service centres with them, and also as a result of using violence as a response to an interaction with us. Behaviour which is completely unacceptable anywhere, anytime, in the home, on the street, or in our service centres. The department takes steps to make sure our staff are safe at work. Although we'd prefer it wasn't necessary, we train our staff to deal with customer violence. And in some locations, we do employ security staff, which managers tell me has a discernible deterrent effect. We provide support to staff who have been in violent work situations, and we work closely with local police as necessary. The job of some of those affected staff will also be to support customers who are experiencing family and domestic violence, in itself a challenging and domestic task. Then to face violence or abuse in the workplace, whether in person or by phone, can only exacerbate the impact on those staff. That's one difficult aspect of the job done by human services staff. It does become more complex, though. Last year, I received another email escalation notice. I read it several times. I know exactly where I was when it arrived. I sat in a car, uncomprehending. It said one of our human services staff had been murdered by her husband. I truly don't believe anybody in charge of a large organisation expects, during the course of their work day, to be advised of their staff dying as a result of family and domestic violence. I don't. My secretary doesn't. You don't expect it, but it happens. I dread it. I can't actually describe here the full impact that tragic event had on me as a minister, but I do know it was one of the significant drivers bringing me to make these remarks tonight. But why was I so surprised? Family and domestic violence can and does affect anyone, anywhere. As is typical in many family and domestic violence situations, fellow workers are often unaware of the violent lives colleagues suffer outside work and are, of course, also left devastated when they become aware. Less than a month ago, an intoxicated customer stabbed his wife, not fatally, outside one of our service centres. I read that escalation notice with dread. It is impossible in these circumstances not to turn your mind to what we can do, what more can be done, and that's what brings me here tonight. As a person in public life with a voice, as a woman passionate about supporting women in Australian society, as a minister with a profile and position that gives me something of a role in the broad leadership of this nation, I am determined to do what I can to progress the national conversation on family and domestic violence. I want to do more. I want to give a voice to those Australians who do not have one. So I've been reminding myself of the size of the challenge Australia is facing. According to the 2012 ABS Personal Safety Survey, over 132,000 Australian women have experienced violence at the hands of a current or former partner in the past 12 months. That is staggering. That is enough women only to fill Sydney's Allianz Stadium almost three times over. And that's only the number of reported instances. According to the Australian Human Rights Commission, every week in Australia a woman is murdered by her partner or ex-partner. Domestic violence, in fact, accounts for one-fifth of our total number of homicides. According to one online women's group, there have already been 52 family and domestic violence-related deaths in Australia this year. You know, I have even had to adjust that number up several times in the last few days as I have been working on these remarks. I think it was 47 at the end of last week. Let me say, though, this is not an official figure or an official account. It's one tallied by an online group, which does give us an indication of how ad hoc some of the data reporting around this issue is. Ladies and gentlemen, I am talking about women here. While there are men who suffer abuse and violence within the family, and the recent tragic and senseless murder of Adelaide Crows coach Phil Walsh is a timely reminder of this, it is statistically and literally overwhelmingly women who are on the receiving end of family and domestic violence. According to the ABS, almost one in six women have experienced violence from a partner compared to almost one in 19 men. One in 20 women have experienced sexual violence compared to one in 250 men. These are invidious comparisons, but I think it's important to restate them. So let's be clear. Violence is a society-wide issue, but it predominantly affects women and children. Family and domestic violence isn't limited to physical or verbal abuse. It comes in the form of bullying, harassing, isolation, stalking, or financial abuse. And now, in the technological age, we're seeing another worrying trend. Perpetrators are using technology to inflict abuse, to control, to track and to intimidate. If preventing homicides, protecting 132,000 women from experiencing violence each year, isn't reason enough to put an end to this sinister problem, then also consider the economic cost of family and domestic violence. In economic terms, and I don't think it gets any drier than calculating the cost of abuse and violence, family and domestic violence is costing Australians billions of dollars each year. According to KPMG, The cost of family and domestic violence is $19.9 billion each year and rising. To break that figure down, that cost is $8,800 for every man, woman and child in this country. The hurt and sufferings of victims make up about half of the total cost, with the cost to business in lost productivity about $1.6 billion. So not only do we have a strong moral imperative to prevent violence against women, there's a strong economic reason too. At the Commonwealth level, the Prime Minister and Minister Michaelia Cash, the Minister assisting the Prime Minister for Women, have established a COAG advisory panel on reducing violence against women and their children, which is chaired by former Victorian Police Commissioner Ken Lay, with Rosie Batty and Heather Nancarro as deputy chairs. The panel members have expert knowledge across domestic and family violence, sexual assault, online safety, violence within Indigenous and culturally and linguistically diverse communities, and people with disabilities. The panel is advising COAG on practical ways to address violence against women and their children. ANROWS has been given a leading role in increasing our knowledge about family and domestic violence and sexual assault to help us drive informed and strategic policy change to address the levels of violence against women and their children. ANROWS, together with Our Watch, has jointly commissioned a study into the media portrayal and representation of violence against women and their children. The media is such a dominant force in shaping and contributing to the discussion about family violence. That study will provide baseline data on the media portrayal of violence against women, which will give us a vital starting point to measure any changes in attitude resulting from the work being done to address this issue. These initiatives, with others led by Minister Morrison and Minister Cash, are part of the broad Commonwealth response and campaigns addressing a reduction in family and domestic violence. My department comes into contact with victims and survivors of family and domestic violence each and every day, not to mention perpetrators. We have a unique opportunity, and in my view an obligation, to take a lead in addressing family and domestic violence, both in terms of our customers, but also for our staff. Research has identified a number of domestic violence risk factors and particularly vulnerable groups. Some of those groups include, particularly amongst women, young women, women from called and Indigenous backgrounds, pregnant women, and women with disabilities. Risk factors include alcohol and drug use, past experience of violence, depression, separation, people with a disability, and financial stress. And if you compare those risk factors and vulnerable groups to the reasons that customers contact my department, you will see there are certainly crossovers. Some of our customers can present with one or several of these risk factors. However, it is a fallacy to believe that family and domestic violence only affects people who have fallen on hard times. These issues are correlated, but they are not necessarily the cause of family and domestic violence. In Centrelink alone, we have 7 million customers. While child support helps 1.4 million separated parents to transfer money to support more than 1.2 million children across Australia. Each weekday, the department handles 220,000 calls, while an average of 100,000 people a day visit one of our 400 service centres around Australia. Our customers contact us at times when they may be vulnerable and going through personal turmoil. They may have lost their job, are ill or injured, or have had a relationship breakdown, or lost a loved one, and or are experiencing family and domestic violence. Customers who are experiencing family and domestic violence may be eligible for a range of payments and services, and our staff work with customers to identify the best possible supports available for them. We also have a network of social workers who offer counselling and support. As well as helping victims to obtain appropriate payments, our social workers play an important role in linking victims with state and community support services. In the last financial year, 48,468 contacts were made with the departmental social workers about family and domestic violence, over 1,000 more than the previous year. This is not a small issue. In conjunction with the National Plan to Reduce Violence Against Women and Their Children, my department has developed a family and domestic violence strategy. As part of this strategy, Human Services is implementing its family and domestic violence risk identification and referral model, initially in the child support program. This process requires child support staff to ask customers if they're concerned about their safety or their family's safety during certain telephone conversations. If the customer identifies a concern, the staff member will offer appropriate support, potentially engaging the customer with one of our departmental social workers, or by providing contact numbers for relevant community organisations, or a direct transfer to 1800 RESPECT, Australia's National Sexual Assault Domestic Violence Counselling Service. Separation can often commence or increase family and domestic violence. Customer feedback from the early trials suggests that people appreciate being asked if they have concerns for their own safety. The model ensures that staff have a systematic and consistent referral process to connect customers with the support services they need when they need it. While child support staff are experienced in working with customers who have very complex matters, they're given comprehensive training in responding to violence, in responding to people who are identified as experiencing family and domestic violence concerns. We are expanding this model to other areas of the business and adapting it for face-to-face and online service delivery channels. Human Services is often described as the face of the government to Australian people. Nowhere is this more the case than in remote and regional Indigenous communities. We know that family and domestic violence occurs far too often in these communities, and it's a very complex issue for those victims and our staff to deal with. I'm acutely aware that implementing the risk identification and referral model in these communities will not be a simple task. I also know that it's one further initiative among many that the government is implementing to improve the lives of Indigenous Australians. I do believe the model will help to ensure victims of violence receive the support they need, and I look forward to working with the Minister for Indigenous Affairs to make this happen. Both I and my personal staff, with senior members of the department, attended a risk identification and referral training session ourselves last week, delivered by a senior human services social worker. I think it's important for me to know and understand how the department is approaching this. I have mentioned the size of the task. Recent statistics from state and territory police suggest that police across Australia deal with an estimated 657 domestic violence matters on average every day of the year. That's one incident every 2 minutes in basically every community. Wealthy, poor, urban, rural, your town, my suburb. So frankly, family and domestic violence isn't a socio-economic issue. As I've said, it's everybody's issue. Simple fact is that there are people who on some level feel it is justifiable to terrorise their partner, their family, in the confines of their own home. When I spoke earlier about the size of my department and its work, I didn't mention the size of our workforce. After Defence, my department is the largest employer in the public service. We have more than 34,000 staff, of whom almost 25,000, or more than 70%, are women. That makes me one of the largest employers of women in the country. To give you an idea of our staff profile and size, Human Services employs roughly the same number of people as the Commonwealth Bank overall, but about 5,000 more women. According to the publicly available information from the Workplace Gender Equality Agency, if my department was a private company, it would be the third largest employer of women in Australia. And if you're wondering, it's only the big supermarket chains, Coles and Woolworths, who employ more women than Human Services, 55,000 and 96,000 respectively. Of my staff, 5,000 work in Canberra. The rest are spread around the country, many in country towns. Accepting that family violence and domestic violence is happening here in Sydney and in regional centres and country towns, then unfortunately, it's most likely to be the experience of some of my staff as well. I want the Department of Human Services to lead the way in the public sector in its support for both our customers and our staff who are victims of family and domestic violence. I have given much thought to what human services can do in leadership terms to provide support to our staff, and what that leadership can mean in terms of the Australian Public Service. How can we become the best practice workplace in the APS? What I would like to see in human services is a, or preferably the, best practice work environment in the public service. That anyone on our staff finding themselves in this position, or knowing someone with whom they work is in this position, is well informed about the supports available, feels comfortable about raising their problem with appropriate staff without thought of stigma or negativity, knows that we care and can provide support, that we have, for example, provided easily accessible information and access to tools like 1-800-RESPECT for them. And they are only my ideas. There is much more being done. I couldn't be more grateful to the Secretary and her executive team who are fully engaged on this challenge with me. I have been so impressed by their preparedness to work with me, advise me, and guide the department in developing our work practices to achieve this. As I said, we have done the training. We also all sat down as a team with Sex Discrimination Commissioner, the exceptional Elizabeth Broderick, last month, to discuss her perspective and to learn from her experience in this area. The reality for us is, how can my staff ask customers who may be the victims of family and domestic violence whether they are at risk and in need of support, if any of those staff who may need it are not being appropriately encouraged to seek support themselves? In my view, we have an obligation to have our own house in order to allow us to most effectively engage with our customers. And that's why I'm driving this work. The Department of Human Services will become a model employer to support victims, survivors, and others impacted by family and domestic violence. To do this, the department has to be a place where it's okay to talk about family and domestic violence, where managers and staff know what to do when someone is experiencing family and domestic violence, where staff can identify issues and support each other and their customers. I've spent the past few months speaking to several highly experienced leaders in the family and domestic violence space, including Karen Willis, the Executive Officer of Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia, Paul Lanossier from Our Watch, Mu Bolch, the CEO of Domestic Violence New South Wales, Elizabeth Broderick, and also the National Manager of Social Work Services in the department. I have listened to their perspectives on what it means to be a model employer for addressing family and domestic violence. I've been working closely with my Secretary, Catherine Campbell, about what we can do to support our staff and our customers who may be experiencing family and domestic violence. In our department, I am very pleased to say we're not starting this journey from scratch. We begin from a solid base of positive work that's been done in addressing family and domestic violence for our customers over many, many years. We know, though, that to advance and progress this work, to take up the heightened focus on the issue of family domestic violence and meet the need that is being created by the current national discussion, we have to change in some ways, and that includes cultural change. And cultural change must start at the top. Barry Sanderson, the Deputy Secretary of my department, will be leading the cultural shift. Barry will take on a leadership role for staff experiencing family and domestic violence, engaging in discussions with managers across the department, changing our language where we need to, and supporting staff to support each other. We have established an experienced family and domestic violence contact officer network, improved resources for managers, and made enhanced information on our websites more accessible. We'll be placing targeted communications about support across the department to ensure all staff are aware of it. Staff and customers will soon begin to see the rollout of our Enough campaign. David Learmont, also Deputy Secretary, is leading the work on our processes and responses for customers, as well as the risk identification and referral model. A new family and domestic violence icon will appear on our homepage, linking directly to a range of information to support people impacted by family and domestic violence. That family and domestic violence information has also been added to our service finder function, and we've developed specific messaging for social media. This communications program and more, internally and externally, will commence from tomorrow. I am very proud to announce these developments tonight. I know that it is a major step, and following it, there will be more work. But the staff of the Department of Human Services can be confident that it is the right step. It's an important step, and hopefully it will encourage other agencies to take a similar path. Because family and domestic violence so often happens behind closed doors, collecting data is difficult. There's still much we don't know about victims, and also importantly, about identifying which strategies are most effective at addressing the issue. Please just bear with me for a moment while I draw some comparisons to the way we address and report on what has long been regarded as another critical national issue, our road toll. I call our appalling road toll of the 1970s a national crisis of behaviour, either bad or stupid or both. Similar to our willful destruction of our skin in Australian summers before the anti-skin cancer campaigns, and our high levels of smoking before the quit campaigns. Australia has made impressive headway reducing our road toll from almost 3,800 deaths in 1970 to 1,193 in 2013. On a per head of population basis, our road toll is now about one-fifth that it was in 1970, a considerable achievement. Indeed, I can tell you that unfortunately the first death on the nation's roads this year occurred 10 minutes after midnight, when a 35-year-old male motorcycle rider collided with another vehicle in a 100km/h zone in Victoria. I found all that information out from one ABS spreadsheet after a quick Google search. But I can't do the same to confidently identify the first victim of family and domestic violence in 2015. We don't have an official equivalent data capture. In comparing domestic violence and road trauma, I know they are vastly different problems of both scale and complexity. But I have come to the view that we need to look at what has worked before to change bad behaviours and use good experience where we can. I believe the way this country has steadily chipped away at the road toll, a problem for which many in the past thought there was no solution, may provide the basis of a plan for reducing family and domestic violence. Like domestic violence, the road toll is a multifaceted issue with no single underlying factor and no borders. As such, we've taken a multifaceted and highly nuanced approach to reducing the road toll. Mandatory seatbelts, random breath testing, speed cameras, airbags, driver education, vehicle restrictions, improved road design, they've all made significant impacts in reducing the road toll. These are evidence-based changes and they've worked. Coupled with sustained media campaigns, they've fundamentally changed our driving culture for the better. We haven't avoided picking on particular demographics either. We deliberately targeted young men in the pinky wagging television commercials because we know there's an issue with young men driving recklessly. We needed to find a way to speak to that demographic. I bet we can all list at least one road toll campaign phrase. Fatigue kills, slow down, the bloody idiot campaign, Plan B, and the very special drink, drive and score a date with a blonde, the blonde being a judge on the bench wearing a blonde judicial wig. Without being overly simplistic, but using these campaigns as an example, we can drill down into the demographic profiles, socioeconomic position and other indicators used in these successful campaigns and perhaps identify and use similar tools as a coordinated option for addressing and reducing family and domestic violence. Each of these incremental changes in addressing road trauma, big and small, has saved lives and perhaps prevented many more drivers from being maimed. Professor Rod McClure, the director of the Monash Injury Research Institute, has said that critical to the success of the long-term strategic approach to make our roads safer was the continual engagement of the public in the debate, ensuring the community was a stakeholder in the cause. He has also highlighted the importance of community leaders standing up and calling for an end to the carnage. And that's what I'm doing tonight. We shouldn't shy away from looking at this approach to reducing domestic violence, just because domestic violence is a big, complicated problem. It doesn't mean we should overlook the small steps each of us can take to prevent it. We have to stop thinking that family and domestic violence is someone else's problem that happens to other people. It happens to your colleagues and your neighbours and your staff and your friends. But we can't let the size and complexity of the problem overwhelm us, and we need to take action, however we can, to start to make a difference. Making the Department of Human Services a better place to work for survivors of family and domestic violence is not going to stop the violence. But we shouldn't be afraid to take more small steps now to achieve bigger outcomes in the long term. In the department, we might not be perfect every time or immediately, but we will make it easier for other Commonwealth departments and other large organisations to follow suit. If I can make it easier for just one of our staff members or one of our customers to speak up about their situation and remove themselves from danger, then we've made a difference.
Many thanks, Senator Payne. And I say also thanks to Allens for providing this facility today, to the legal firm Allens. And as normal, we'll take questions from our members and any journalists here can talk to the Minister or the Minister's staff later. But this is for our members tonight. So we've got about 20 minutes. Bit over 20 minutes. You made the point about the difficulty of collecting data, and I mean, as you know, and as we all know, domestic violence is primarily a criminal matter of the responsibility of state governments, not overwhelmingly, but certainly primarily. We don't really know what happened to domestic violence in decades gone by, but what do you know from your own advisors about the homicide rate here, because that's something that can be documented, that seems to have increased. Is that the case, or does it just seem to be the case?
I believe from my reading in recent times that yes, it is absolutely the case. As I said, one in five homicides in Australia is a domestic violence homicide, and four out of five of those are committed by an intimate partner. So statistically, the prevalence is increasing, and we've discussed this with Elizabeth Broderick, the Sex Discrimination Commissioner. And that is one of the reasons, I think, why since Rosie Batty was made Australian of the Year at the beginning of this year, that there has been a quite fervent conversation. We did actually have at the beginning of the year, after the first 3 months of the year, if I recall correctly, 12 weeks, 24 dead women. That was a fairly confronting statistic and certainly an increased number of victims.
So just stay here and...
Not going far, I was just coughing.
Sorry. Okay, so there's a question here. Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Maurice Payne. I run a Facebook group, Royal Commission into Domestic Violence. I'm looking nationally. Made up of 1,200 men and women members. Now, my comment here is Martin Place evidenced Mad Monis, alleged 40 rapes and attempted murder charge is a bailable offence. Where should, in domestic violence, the line be drawn with bail with regards to rape and attempted murder as allegations? And then where do you see a Royal Commission nationally, if I can get a comment on that? Thank you.
Thanks, Sylvia.
So the initial question about the Mad Monis bail decision, and secondly about the Royal Commission.
I think both popular commentary and my personal view, without wishing to reduce the decisions of the judiciary, is that bail decisions of that nature are regrettable and certainly merit significant examination. I'm not, however, the person sitting in judgment. So, you know, value my legal education, but the idea of traducing all of those decisions from this lectern is not something I'm going to do. But I think everyone has said that there is clearly an issue in the process when an individual can be responsible for the perpetration of that number of offences and be repeatedly released on bail. They would say the same thing in relation to the individual who committed the appalling murder of Jill Maher in Melbourne. In relation to a Royal Commission nationally, I actually think some of the things that we're doing now are potentially more constructive. I'm watching with interest the Royal Commission into Family Violence in Victoria, and I've been reading some of that evidence with great interest. But if you think about what the COAG panel is designed to do and the individuals who constitute that panel, you would be hard-pushed to bring together a more skilled and experienced group of people to look at these issues with the support of all of the states and territories and the Commonwealth. Ken Lay, a man who clearly likes to take on a big job given he's grappling with the epidemic of ICE in the country as well as domestic and family violence, Ken Lay is eminently well-placed in chairing that particular group with, as I said, great expertise with him. So I think I might reserve my opinion in relation to a National Royal Commission because I would like to think that there are more constructive ways to address this issue. I also wouldn't like to leave tonight with anyone thinking that I've walked away from issues concerning perpetrators, because I haven't. The most important thing, though, I think, with people who are currently in a situation of violence, is to ensure that they have the support they need to look after themselves. And that is the first step in this process. As I said, there's much more work to be done.
There's a question here, then we come here. Yes. Don't stand in front of the camera. Yeah.
Thank you, Minister. Bearing in mind that the recidivism rate of people coming out of jails in Australia is over 60%, and that a lot of these people coming out of jail, men coming out of jail, do get involved in domestic violence, and also bearing in mind there's only one jail in Australia that really, really does good work in terms of helping these people in jail with their self-esteem, etc. I'm just wondering if your department or your other ministers in other areas, if there could be a crossover in terms of helping these men who come out of jail to boost their self-esteem, because self-esteem is a major, major issue of why there is domestic violence.
It's a question about men coming out of prison with low self-esteem.
We certainly have a role to play in supporting individuals who are leaving prison. And I've been in a number of service centres from time to time where individuals have literally come from the court to our service centre on release to be assisted with appropriate payments and dealing with reinstating identification, Medicare and things like that. Beyond that, we don't have a significant role to play with those individuals to the best of my knowledge. And I think we're a big organisation. I think perhaps a more targeted community-based support is perhaps more appropriate in that context. But I do take the point of what you're saying. I'm not as well-versed in Australia's jail system as you obviously are, because I'm not even sure which particular jail you're referring to as one of best practice. But it does seem to me that that we have chicken and egg issues in this process. I mean, people are not necessarily made more violent in prison, but certainly vulnerable to the development of even greater tendencies to violence. That must be, that's certainly the case. And any action which can be taken to minimise that being unleashed on an unsuspecting community or even close familiars would certainly be welcome.
Especially
here. Yes, in the case of Darcy Freeman, who was thrown over Westgate Bridge by her father, the mother apparently had told the doctor, told other people, that she felt the father was a threat to the children, which she'd seen evidence of that. Now, is there any way of doing anything when a person is afraid someone's going to attack the children? They can be.
There was a question about the Westgate Bridge case in Melbourne and the mother having been concerned that the husband was going to attack the children.
There are certainly a lot of examples which fill the media annals and the history books where hindsight is 2020. I wish I had 2020 hindsight or 2020 forward vision to address some of those. We have a range of systems in place to mark alerts, to raise issues, and if I may say, the risk identification and referral model that I spoke about tonight being implemented in my department is particularly targeted to being able to identify cues from individuals who are speaking to my staff, to utilise those in conjunction with our social workers or other appropriate resources to engage with that customer on what the issue might be. Now, it may be a threat to themselves, and I said we ask them whether they feel concerned for their own safety or for their family. In a situation which involves child support at the moment, in that case, then we, I think, are making very, very important progress in identifying those cues and supporting those customers and their families.
Down the back.
This issue of domestic violence, unlike deaths on the road and whatever, is so much more complex. And you've got the image of the caveman with his wife pulling her along by the hair and his club in his hand. And go back four or five decades and the police hardly took domestic violence seriously, so we've come a long way. But as you think about the problem, isn't it really the problem of it being a private matter and the difficulty of getting through the barriers of the private home and all of that? And the other problem is how many different departments really do you need to tap into to be in education for one, to try and break through the mentality in many people that this is, you know, for the family, not for the public. So how do you see the campaign going forward in the sense of, you know, how many different levels do we need to treat this on? Because there's psychology, there's education, there's criminality. You've got a whole range of different areas that you're going to have to tackle this from.
So there's absolutely no question that this has to be tackled at multiple levels, and they involve multiple jurisdictions, just for a start. And I've been dealing tonight with essentially what I can do and what we can do in the space in which I work. I work very closely with Senator Michaelia Cash in her work as the Minister Assisting the Prime Minister for Women on this particular issue, and we are in lockstep in matching the work that we do. I know that Minister Goward in New South Wales has most recently made, in my view, an extraordinarily important decision about education in schools, which I applaud and commend as highly as I possibly can, because the story of the young girl who thought that her family environment was normal, in inverted commas, had no reason to think otherwise, would have to be one of the most compelling stories any of us has heard in a long time. And I also congratulate the New South Wales State Government for the speed with which they were able to accomplish that change. It's not easy. Turning around a department of 34,000 people to change parts of the way we work is significantly speedier than turning around the Queen Mary, but it's not overnight. And these sorts of undertakings have to go across jurisdictions and across departments. I come back to the COAG committee, the COAG panel as well, because I do think that the selection of an individual like Ken Lay, academics, people with personal experience like Rosie Batty, will really make a difference to the way that panel is able to deliver. If the person as experienced in policing as Ken Lay can't make a contribution about how police forces can work better with my Department of Human Services, with state education departments, then the COAG panel won't work. But I actually have very strong confidence in its capacity.
There's a question down there.
You made reference to the national plan, and I know this is now in its third 3 years. Is it now under that COAG panel, and how would you comment on the impact of that, the bringing together of all the jurisdictions and the five strategies there?
It's under the leadership of Minister for Social Services, Scott Morrison, with Senator Michaelia Cash, the Minister, as I said previously, assisting the Prime Minister for Women in its implementation. So all of the, a lot of the work that they are doing is part of the plan. And we are, as a department, as I said, developing our own family and domestic violence strategy, doing that also in response to the national plan. So it has an extremely holistic across-government capacity. And one of the visions, for want of a better word, that I have and that I think the department shares is that given our size and the strength that we have of numbers within the Australian public sector, that we can certainly provide leadership and templates and engagement for much smaller organisations that don't necessarily have the capacity to do the work that we've done in preparation for rolling out not just our risk identification and referral model, but all the work that we are doing for staff and for customers. And we can literally be a leader and facilitator for other smaller units within the Commonwealth Public Service. And that is all responsive to the National Plan.
We're getting close to the end. If I missed anyone? Anyway, we've got a few more minutes. Just going back to the earlier point, I mean, obviously, the homicide rate is increasing, as your points indicate. So if the homicide rate is increasing, you would expect the general rate of domestic violence is also increasing. What do you advisers tell you about the reason why this might be the case? What would be, because in other areas homicide doesn't appear to be increasing as a percentage of total homicide. So what's the word in among your advisers to and the police and others to explain this?
I think if we look at increasing numbers of reports of domestic violence, that's not a straight up and down issue. In every sector of social policy where we have worked over years to encourage more reporting, you then get increased numbers. And so we are able to say that there are more reported instances of domestic and family violence than previously. A combination in my personal view, because I'm not a social worker and not at the coalface in my department. So a combination of factors, Jared, of increased reporting and increased instances, where there is, by many reports and a lot of academic research, a greater culture of violence in some communities than there has historically been. A greater acceptance of the use of violence. Acceptance is the wrong word. A greater use of violence by some cohorts in the community than there has previously been. So if you combine both of those factors, I think that leads to the sort of statistic that our social workers have provided me with in looking at what we can do within our department. So over 48,500 departmental interactions with our social workers relating directly to family and domestic violence in this financial year, a growth of 1,000 from the previous financial year. And my assessment from what I have been working on in recent months is that would be a combination of those factors, both greater reporting and more incidents of domestic violence.
So
this is
going to be very brief, yes?
There's a widespread opinion, at least I note a number of people say, that in New South Wales at the moment there seems to be some reassessment of beds and accommodation in refuges and that they are actually being reduced.
Well, some suggestion that beds and refuges have been reduced, but that's a state government matter. I don't know whether you...
It is very much a state government matter, and when I have been speaking with our domestic violence coordinators here in New South Wales, with constituents who raise issues, I think the implementation, and I'm going to get the title wrong, so I'm not even going to try, the implementation of the program the New South Wales government pursued last year was looking for best practice in this particular space. I know that the Minister, Brad Hazzard, has said in recent months that if there are issues of overcrowding, then he is definitely prepared to look at that. But in funding terms and in volume terms, the contribution is more significant than it has ever been. In practical terms, we seem to be dealing with a bigger problem.
Quick question there. It's going to be quick. Yep.
The organisation called Aunties and Uncles, which is a mentoring organisation where adults are going into broken homes, etc., for doing the mentoring process. The organisation almost went broke a few years ago, and the Wesley Mission saved them. And I'm just wondering if your department helps organisations like that, or that specific
organisation. The question is whether your department helps organisations like Aunties and Uncles, which got into financial trouble some years ago.
We don't directly fund organisations in that way. They're funded, whether it be through the Department of Social Services or Health or Education or whatever the particular policy context is, but Human Services doesn't directly fund organisations in that way.
So finally, what's your message to the Prime Minister and the Cabinet? I mean, you've obviously been looking at this, you've got your speech here tonight, but when you talk to government, what more can the Commonwealth government do as distinct from the states and the territories?
I think the Commonwealth can continue the leadership established around the development of the COAG panel. I think that I would very much like to see other departments take a lead from the work that the Department of Human Services, my secretary, our deputy secretaries and senior staff are doing. Because if we can put in place best practice, if we can actually lay that ground for the Commonwealth public sector, then we will impact almost 160,000 Commonwealth public servants and all of the customers with which they engage if they're engaging on these sorts of issues. I think that is a capacity to make an extraordinary difference and make an extraordinary difference in a very, very effective and efficient way.
Many thanks. What if, great to have Senator Payne back at the Institute, this time as a minister in the Abbott government, and an important speech tonight on a tragically important topic. But what we've seen tonight and heard tonight is Senator Payne coming up with some new initiatives and giving a comprehensive overview of what the Commonwealth government is trying to do about this most serious problem. So for tonight, Maurice Payne, many thanks. Thank you. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.